I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Last fall, a graphic and disturbing report by a Pennsylvania grand jury detailed allegations of the sexual abuse of eight boys by former Penn State assistant football coach Jerry Sandusky, founder of a program for at-risk youth called The Second Mile. It was a shocking story that was news to much of the country, but not our guests. Sarah Ganim had been investigating these allegations for several years and first reported on them in March 2011. For the Harrisburg Patriot News and continues to cover the story today. Last week, she won the Pulitzer Prize for local reporting, one of the highest honors in journalism. We invited Sarah Ganim and the assistant managing editor of the Harrisburg Patriot News, Mike Feely, to join us on Radio Times. And Sarah, congratulations. Nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you.
And Mike Feely, thank you very much for joining us as well.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. And Sarah, let me begin with you. And I guess it's the typical question when someone wins a Pulitzer Prize. Has it sunk in yet? Have you come back down to earth?
I think we definitely are back down. We came to back down pretty quickly when news started to break again, you know, very shortly after it happened. And I think Mike and I worked probably a 15-hour day on Wednesday and worked all through the weekend. So it's definitely sunk in.
So you're back to work again.
Absolutely.
What I appreciate so much about what you did, and I think what the Pulitzer Prize appreciates or certainly acknowledges, is first of all the work of local reporters and the fact that you had been working on this story for several years, even before it was published almost a little bit more than a year ago.
Yeah, and that was something that I wanted to get across to our staff, especially in that moment, was that this is really a testament to local reporting. And one of the most rewarding things for us personally has been the amount of people who have said to us, you know, this kind of restores my faith in local journalism. I realize why it's so important, and especially in financial times and with cutbacks and layoffs and less ink and paper, you know, the actual newspaper, people are realizing that we still do a lot of really good work, and I think that sometimes gets lost. And really, it was a win for every local newsroom in this country that does what we do every day. We just happen to have this story.
And a big prize that goes along with it. Mike, do you agree with that?
Oh, very much so. This whole story was based on local reporting, so it was really just that kind of great work that that pushed this story along.
Well, Sarah, beginning in the beginning, you were actually working at a different paper, and you got a tip. What was the tip?
Yeah, I got a phone call basically from it was actually a conversation that occurred during a phone call on a different story. I had gotten into the habit of asking all of my sources, something that I really still do to this day. You know, what else do you know? What else is going on? And I got this tip about Jerry Sandusky. And it really wasn't something that I began working on a daily basis, but something I was chipping away at as I was in the process of doing, you know, my beat at a small paper with six reporters. It wasn't really until I came to the Patriot News and where there's a little, you know, it's a little bit bigger of a staff, a little more resources, and more importantly, the emphasis on this kind of work where they were able to give me the time to work on it full time, really for a few weeks before we had anything we could go with.
And what was the tip, Sarah?
Well, the tip was that Jerry Sandusky was under investigation.
Oh, and this was almost an aside from someone that you were talking with? Oh, by the way?
Yeah, basically. Yep.
And did you begin to look at that, or did you kind of park it, in a sense, mentally park it and work on, continue to work on the stories that you were working on?
It was interesting. I began to look into it and really didn't get anywhere. And that same source contacted me a few weeks later and said, hey, remember that thing I told you? It's not true. And, I had no reason not to believe that person. That things like this are alleged all the time, and he was Jerry Sandusky, so, you know, maybe it wasn't true. Although it never really left my mind. And when it began to appear on online message boards, when he was no longer attending charity functions, he had this children's charity that he was very well involved in, and when he stopped that, you know, my reporter brain kind of kicked in and said, something's not right here. And that's when we really ramped up the investigative reporting and the knocking on doors and calling people.
And I should say that you began at this Center Daily Times. That's in State College, Pennsylvania. You were working as a crime reporter at the time.
Right.
And then you went over to where you are now, the Harrisburg Patriot News.
Correct.
Mike, picking up on the story, I'm curious how your paper got involved and the kind of support that you wanted to give Sarah as she was doing her investigation.
Well, we had a similar tip. A reporter here was working on roughly around the same time, but we weren't getting any traction here either. So when we brought Sarah on board, it became evident she was not only a great reporter, but had some more information than we had on this. So the decision was just made to let her go full-time on this. Now, that's State College is 90 minutes away from here, so Sarah had to spend most of her time on the road, you know, just knocking on doors, and we were just trying to give her as much time as she needed to get this story.
Is it unusual for one reporter to work full-time on one story, Mike?
For us, for any length of time, yes. We knew, though, the only way we were going to get this one is to let her go out there, let her do what she had to do, give her as much support as we could here with other reporters kind of working around the edges, but just kind of let her do that old-fashioned news reporting, which was, you know, again, knocking on doors, talking to people, getting people to trust her.
And Sarah, I know you talked to a number of different people. Was there an individual interview that began to open up this story for you?
Actually, no, it's interesting. I mean, really, it was a lot of little pieces. And we had the task of then not only sorting them out and putting them together and trying to figure out where everything fit, but then, you know, making sure that we weren't influencing the story in any kind of way because we had such little tidbits of information from so many different people. So what we did was we set a really high standard for how many sources we needed on every particular fact and made sure that those sources were not related in any way and would have been independent from each other in their knowledge. And it's a big credit to our Patriot News lawyer who really walked us through down to the detail of how do you ask a question to make sure that you don't begin to spread rumor that might eventually get back to you. Spent a lot of time with her. And in the end, we were so confident in that story. We had only one person with a material information, I felt, that was on the record with their name, and all of the rest of them were unnamed sources, but we slept fine that night before it ran in March because we really felt very confident. There was no doubt in my mind that it wasn't correct.
And why didn't people want to come forward? Why were they? I know there was a grand jury investigation, but why were people reluctant to go on the record?
You know, I can't speak for everybody. I some of the themes I heard, you know, a lot of people believed a grand jury, they shouldn't talk about a grand jury because it is done in secret. Even witnesses who are permitted by law to talk still believe that they shouldn't. Again, I think also it had to do with the nature of this case and who Jerry Sandusky is and what he represented at that time. And people just didn't feel comfortable. They didn't want to be the person saying it. That was my impression from a lot of interviews. You know, we talked to some people multiple times. We had people who lied to us, and not just like lied, you know, one lie, go away, but elaborate stories that were designed to throw us off track and put us on a different trail. It was really quite fascinating. I can't explain it. I mean, it's what we experienced, but I'm not, you know, I have no idea what their motives were.
Well, that's interesting. Why do you think they were trying to throw you off the trail, or it felt that way?
I can't explain their motives, but that's what, you know, we saw that more than once.
Mike, do you have any theories about that?
No theories on that other than, you know, I think the topic and the person that was being investigated. I have to admit, when we first started talking about this, since Jerry Sandusky had not been at Penn State for probably at least a decade, I actually had to Google who he was.
Interesting.
And then when I started reading about the guy, I mean, in the State College area, not only if, you know, big time former football coach, but a children's charity, he was, you know, legend up there. So I think it was the subject matter. I don't think the families of alleged victims initially wanted to talk. Sarah did an amazing job of gaining the trust of those families over time, but I don't think if a reporter shows up at your door, they necessarily want to spill all their details right away, and that it just took a lot of gaining their trust before they would talk.
Well, let me pick up on that and go back to you, Sarah, and obviously you're knocking on the door. They don't know who you are. How did you gain their trust, or how did you develop a kind of relationship where you could get some of these people to talk with you?
It wasn't just me, you know, like some of these people weren't even talking to police. They were that uncomfortable with the situation. But the bottom line, I think, is that we approached this as a crime story, not as a sports story from the beginning. And, you know, I've done a lot of crime reporting. This isn't the first door I've knocked on where on the other side is a victim of a crime or someone who, you know, would rather not talk. But the bottom line is that a lot of times people understand that it is better to have more information than to have less information. And I think that we always get a more complete story. That feeling in your stomach as a reporter never goes away when you're about to knock on someone's door who's been wronged or allegedly and it was a victim of a crime and say, hey, you know, you don't know me, but spill your guts to me, basically. Yeah. And that never gets any better. But afterward, when they do talk to you, there's always that feeling of, you know you're doing the right thing. You know you're doing something good for that person. There are plenty of examples of this. I mean, I covered once a student at Penn State who was very badly injured basically for life, in a DUI crash, and going to the hospital and talking to his parents in ICU was incredibly difficult. But because of the stories, he was able to get the necessary treatment to stay alive. His parents couldn't have otherwise afforded it, but people donated to help the cause. And that's the same situation in every crime story. There's, you know, there's some good that comes of it. And that's why we do it. That's why we tell these stories. And so, you know, as a human being, you never really overcome that sensitivity that you don't want to bother these people. But you really, you know, it's very important.
Yeah. And do they appreciate what you and the newspaper has done to shed light on this story?
You know, again, I don't want to speak for them, but I think that they do. We haven't gotten as much negative feedback, as much pushback as I think Mike and I anticipated. And he might be better suited to answer those questions. Sometimes he gets the brunt of the emails.
Well, I was wondering about that. Mike, go ahead.
Well, I think the victims, the alleged victims, the parents, in the end, really appreciated the work we did. I always remember the quote. It was the day after Sandusky was indicted, and it was the mother of one victim when we talked to her. She said, I just got goosebumps. I just lived with this for so long, and it killed me when people talked about him like he was a god, and I knew he was a monster. And I think there was this huge sense of relief for her and then and others. And what we're really kind of most proud of, and it didn't hit us till much, much later, is that I think it's 6 of the 8 known alleged victims came forward after our story came out.
Interesting.
And that's something, despite any criticism we have received, and we've received a lot, but we've received a lot of praise as well. But that sort of puts it all into perspective, why we're doing this.
Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with Mike Feely. He's assistant managing editor of the Harrisburg Patriot News, and Sarah Ganim. She's a crime reporter for the paper and won the Pulitzer Prize for local reporting last week for her coverage of the alleged Jerry Sandusky child sex abuse scandal involving Penn State and a charity that he runs as well. We're going to take a very short break, and then we'll get right back to our conversation. Stay with us.
Hello, this is Margaret Kuo. Sunday, April 29th, I'll host a Madame Butterfly dinner. Miss Butter, formerly of New York City Opera, will perform selections from Puccini's masterpiece and traditional Japanese numbers. Margaret Kuo supports WHYY.
The University of Pennsylvania supports WHYY. Do your drinking habits cause problems in your personal or professional life? Do you drink to cope with stress? These may be signs of alcohol dependence. UPenn is conducting a research study using naltrexone, an FDA-approved medication for use in treating alcoholism. If you are 18 or older, have an alcohol problem, and want to reduce your drinking, you may qualify for the study. Details at 215-222-3200, extension 170. 215-222-3200, extension 170.
I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're featuring two Pulitzer Prize winners on Radio Times today. Who couldn't be more different? A 24-year-old crime reporter and an 82-year-old biologist. We present a wide variety of topics and guests on Radio Times, and that's why you listen. So why not make a pledge of support, especially if you've never been a member of WHYY? It's the second day of the spring membership drive. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499. Pledge online at WHYY.org. Thanks.
Supporting WHYY, Fidelity Investments Bucks County Investor Center, located at 1520 Main Street in the Valley Square Shopping Center. Information at 1-800-FIDELITY or fidelity.com. Fidelity Brokerage Services, member NYSE SIPC.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoane. The Pulitzer Prizes were announced last week, and Sarah Ganim, crime reporter for the Patriot News of Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, won the award for local reporting on the alleged sex scandal involving former Penn State assistant football coach Jerry Sandusky. She joins us along with Mike Feely, who is assistant managing editor at the paper. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Mike, Sarah had talked about the role that the lawyer at the paper had played in this evolving story. What was their responsibility? And typically, for people that don't work at papers, what is the role of a lawyer?
Well, Pat Clark is our attorney, and her job was to help us get the story in the paper and not try to keep it out of the paper. So as Sarah mentioned earlier, she was a great coach for us in not only looking at the story, but explaining to us how we can carefully ask questions that don't get us into hot water. But what was amazing about Pat was her full intent was to make sure, again, we all slept well that night, and we did. I remember it was one of the moments of this whole year. I remember is we're all crammed into Kate Barron, who's the executive editor. We're all in her office, Sarah, myself, the editor, David Newhouse, and we're reading over the story with Pat on the phone, and it was probably about 2 hours, and she was going over everything, and it's been about the 10th time, 15th time we've had these kind of meetings, and after about 2 hours, she just gets to the end and says, well, we're done.
Wow.
And it was sort of this overwhelming, relief that we sort of satisfied all those answers that she had, as well as all the ones we had. And we ran with it the next day.
And did you truly sleep well that night, Mike?
Yes, I did.
You did? And Sarah as well?
Not many before that, but I actually slept very well.
You felt like
that's the absolute truth. There was no sleep before that. But that night, we had no doubts. I actually was teaching a class at Penn State that semester. The story ran on a Thursday, which was a class day for me. So I actually had to drive up to Penn State and teach journalism students that day. And we didn't talk about it in the class because I didn't want to say anything, that they might tweet out or something. Mm-hmm. But there was absolutely no doubt. I mean, we woke up the next morning like a normal day and went about, being reporters and putting out a newspaper. It was, I slept fine. I absolutely knew that it was factually correct.
And Sarah, did you ever speak with Jerry Sandusky, or did you ever try to speak with Jerry Sandusky?
Of course we tried, but he has to this day not talked to us. Now, his lawyer talks a lot, which is interesting because a lot of times in these high-profile cases, they don't. They stay very quiet. And Sandusky himself has made several public remarks. So it's kind of this interesting situation where, yes, there's been a lot of coverage, but a lot of it has been his side of the story, and he's really had this amazing opportunity to get each and every detail. He's essentially, I know it's cliche, but he really has tried his case already in the media. Every time he has a defense, he puts it right out there for everyone to talk about.
Mike, let me go back to you. You're in the Harrisburg area, closer to Penn State than we are here in Philadelphia. And for those that don't live around there, talk a bit about, I guess, the influence of Penn State, its campus, its alumni, the whole sports football program, just so people can understand the story in the context of the environment that you live in.
Well, Penn State is huge, and Penn State football is a huge driver for both, economics that trickles down here to Harrisburg. You get 100,000-plus people at football games. You have, the largest alumni base in the country. You have Penn State fans all over. That sport of football at Penn State and Joe Paterno were just godlike, legendary. I mean, you would talk, of Joe Paterno as you would the same reverence with Mother Teresa. It's just an incredible influence all over this region. And there's a lot of Penn State fans.
Yeah.
And I think when this news started to come out, and then there was some discussion about Joe Paterno's moral obligation more than he was, you know, than his legal obligation, which they pretty much said he did everything he was supposed to do by the law, but it quickly turned against him on did he do the right thing morally. And that really caused a huge tear in sort of this community here, in the Penn State community, of people who felt he was getting attacked, and then people who felt, you know, he didn't do what he was supposed to do as a person.
And so, I'm assuming you heard from all those sides at your paper?
We heard from all those sides from all over the world, actually. And it's interesting, I would say, and this is unscientific, but the closer you got to Harrisburg, you know, our core area, very, very, very strong defense of Joe Paterno. The further away you got, and then people weren't as passionate about Penn State football, I think the more people were taking a harsher stance against Joe Paterno.
And Sarah, were you surprised when he got fired?
Absolutely. That was something that I just absolutely did not see coming. And I think that there was a clear shift in the momentum of the and the passion and the atmosphere at Penn State that week when he got fired. It was the unthinkable for everyone up there. This was something that was never going to happen. And the fact that he had said he was going to retire earlier that day before he was fired was a shock, too. It was really like a blow to people that, oh my God, this really is his last season. And then for that to be his last day of work, it was just absolutely unthinkable. And it really, there was a shift in the momentum. There was a shift in the anger. I think that we actually got more negative feedback after Joe Paterno became a key part of this story than we did when it was about Jerry Sandusky. That was when the negativity really rose to a different level, and the divide of you were either pro-Paterno or you were not pro-Paterno, and there was nothing in the middle. There's just these two very extremes, and there's no one, not no one, but those people aren't vocal.
Well, and this goes back to McQueary, who had witnessed Sandusky in a shower. And the question, I guess, as you wrote about, actually, Sarah, was what did he tell Paterno? What did Paterno tell Schultz? What did Schultz tell Curley? What did Curley tell Spanier? And you know, how did this report get, in a sense, sort of G-rated as it was given to the next person?
I mean, yeah, that was the discussion for several months. I think it's still a discussion that people are having. And after he died, especially, and it became clear that he wasn't going to take the stand and be cross-examined at trial, you know, it's almost become something that we may never completely answer and exact of, you know, who knew what and when. There's no exact answer except for what he said to the Washington Post in an interview shortly before he died, about a
Paterno.
Week before he died. That's his right, Paterno. That's his last. Last explanation of his side of the story. And it's never going to be something that's going to be decided by a jury or by a courtroom.
And that's Sarah Ganim joining us along with Mike Feely. And Sarah won a Pulitzer Prize last week for her reporting of the alleged sex abuse scandal involving Penn State assistant football coach Jerry Sandusky and eight boys. And she received the award for her investigative reporting. She's a crime reporter at the Patriot News. Also with us is Mike Feely, and he is assistant managing editor at the paper. And we are talking about how they piece this story together. And how they were able to verify a lot of the allegations and able to, frankly, win a Pulitzer Prize for the reporting. We're also taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Mike, we did several shows about this story and the allegations. And I guess there's so many unanswered questions, as Sarah just referenced, but also a frustration that these allegations go back more than 15 years, and still we're, you know, there's a grand jury, yes, but there hasn't been a trial yet. It's coming up. But the kind of frustration, I guess, in seeing that these things had happened over a period of time and yet nothing was done.
Well, I think one of the added layers of intrigue in this story is the missing and declared dead prosecutor up in State College, Ray Grecar, who had a case in front of him and declined to prosecute. And I think that was 1998. And really no one knows why, or if they know, no one has said why. So I think those allegations had got to the point where they had been on his desk. And I think that just, and the fact that he went missing and has been missing for years and was declared dead just adds that layer of, you know, who knew what when, for how long did people know, and why wasn't anything done? When you talk about, you know, Joe Paterno not being able to testify, the fact that Ray Grietkar is not around, again, just, I'm not sure we'll ever know that answer.
Yeah, and Sarah, you wrote about this case. It's complicated. We can't do justice to it on the air, but he disappeared in 2005. He was a Center County prosecutor and has, as you said, been declared dead. What do we need to know about Ray Grietkar?
Well, you know, there's a ton of stuff that I would like to know about Ray Grietkar.
I bet. But what do we know, I guess?
It's another one of those situations where there's a lot of unanswered questions. All we really know is that he took a day off of work. He took a drive to an antique store where he frequented, and he was never seen again. Found his car the next day. They found his laptop in a nearby river about a week later, I believe. And then months later, they found the hard drive to the laptop, and NASA has tried to read this hard drive and can't get anything off of it.
Wow.
The same technicians that were able to get a read on the Shuttle Columbia's hard drive after it broke up in the atmosphere could not read Ray Grietkar's hard drive. And so it just adds to this mystery, which, to be honest with you, was a national story and something that had caught intrigue way before Jerry Sandusky was even, allegations were even made against him publicly. And so it's this strange merge of these two very polarizing stories, and now all of a sudden they're, you know, people are wondering. And I have to say, I think that part of this intrigue has to do with, goes kind of back to this unthinkable happened in Happy Valley, that,
right,
that Joe Paterno was fired and everything was turned on its head. And all of a sudden, rational people who would have never otherwise theorized or given a second thought to this are saying, well, if that could happen, then anything is possible.
Wow.
And so these theories and the rumors are just what were once smoldering or have exploded around Ray Grietkar.
And he had been investigating one of these allegations.
He did it. Well, police investigated it, brought it to him in 1998, and he declined to prosecute.
Right. And again, this case goes back so many years. Mike, I'm curious, when the grand jury report was published last fall, this became a national, even an international story. And I'm assuming you and Sarah and others at your newspaper watched the national, international press descend on this story.
Yeah. The great part about Sarah's reporting was, again, it was all footwork. So as we watched regional and national and international people come in, you know, when Sarah was going toe-to-toe with the New York Times and the Washington Post and ESPN and everybody else, she was always able to stay a step ahead of them. We really used social media and our website, penlive.com, to push the breaking news of the day, which was, for a couple weeks, was, you know, minute by minute. And then Sarah was able to really dig in and write stories that were, you know, posing new questions, challenging who knew what when, and those kind of stories to keep it forward. Now, we always ended the night with a conversation, which Sarah usually ended with, you know, we're going to lose control of this story, we're going to lose control of this story, and then we wouldn't. And then the next day she'd say, we're going to lose control of this story, we're going to lose control of this story. But she was able to always stay a step ahead, and part of it for her, I think, was a little bit of a superhuman strength. She was working 16, 17, 18 hours a day, 7 days a week for, you know, I don't know how long, months.
The kind of gumshoe reporting.
Yeah, from my standpoint, and it was impressive to watch and impressive to participate in. She just did a phenomenal job. Everybody, having her winning the Pulitzer, everybody keeps pointing out her age, and I remind her of her age, that she's 24, and
right,
I think she reminds me that
you're a lot older than her.
When I started here. Yeah, but she was not 24, and this age was not a part of this. She was just doing phenomenal work for anybody of any age.
Well, Sarah, this is a more personal question, but I'm just wondering, here you had been working on this story for several years, had made all sorts of contacts, and then you have the national press, in a sense, parachuting in on the story, and it becomes a big story on the networks and, as you say, the New York Times, other papers that get involved. Were there things that they got wrong because they just hadn't been there from the beginning? Were there egregious things that were said?
If there were, I would not have known. One of the great things I have to say about Mike was that, when he says news was literally breaking by the minute, he's not exaggerating. I'd go into an interview for an hour and come out and I'd miss three things. So there was absolutely no way for me to keep up with what was being reported about this, especially for several weeks, probably for the entire month of November. He was keeping an incredible tab on reading other people's stuff and telling me, you know, here's what you need to know. And if I didn't need to know it, he wasn't bothering me with it. We had some great discussions about how to move the story forward, and I think that that's how we were able to stay a step ahead. I learned a lot from the national media. I actually have great respect for them. But the bottom line is that we were in that community, and we knew exactly where to go, who to talk to, and we could almost anticipate where the story might go. And a lot of times we were wrong, but we could say, you know, yes, all of this happened, XYZ happened in the last 24 hours. Instead of writing a story about everything that just happened in the last 24 hours that everyone already knows about, let's tell them what's next. What do they need to know? What does this mean for them? How do we move this story forward? And that's a philosophy we have at the Patriot News on every single story that we write. And so that's where I think that we had the advantage when you talk about local reporting versus national reporting. Obviously, in some ways, national reporting is local reporting on a really big scale, right? But in this case, we had that advantage, and that's what helped us.
Mike, picking up on what Sarah just said then, and we have about a minute or so before we have to say goodbye. So what is next when it comes to the Jerry Sandusky case?
You know, people keep asking us, when's this going to not be on the front page anymore? And I said, well, there's currently, I think, seven investigations going on. The grand jury's still meeting, federal investigation, NCAA, et cetera, et cetera. A trial coming up scheduled for June for Jerry Sandusky. We've got Curley and Schultz, the other two charged in this case, they have a trial probably in the fall. There is just so much still going on that it's hard to encapsulate in one sentence. This is just going to be going on for a long time.
And Sarah, do you still sleep next to a police scanner?
Yeah, but it's turned off now.
It's turned off now, but for
it's
a while.
It's turned off, yes.
But that's because you're a crime reporter, right?
That's because when I was on the beat, yeah. I mean, I wanted to know what was happening all the time, not just when I was at the office. And right now, while I'm on this story and this story only, I don't need to hear about the fire down the street. Unfortunately, I do feel a little guilty about that, but it's turned off right now. So.
Well, congratulations again, Sarah. Thanks for joining us today in Radio Times.
Thank you.
You're welcome. And she's Sarah Ganim, crime reporter for the Harrisburg Patriot News, and won the Pulitzer Prize for local reporting last week for her coverage of the Jerry Sandusky Penn State child sex abuse scandal. Mike Feely, thank you for joining us as well.
Thank you.
And he's assistant managing editor at the Harrisburg Patriot News. We have waiting in the wings, Carrie Morgan, executive director of the Greater Philadelphia Coalition Against Hunger. We'll be right back.
AT12 Productions, Philadelphia's all-comedy theater company, supports WHYY. On now at 1812 Productions, Boston Marriage, the celebrated comedy by renowned American playwright David Mamet. Boston Marriage stars Grace Gunglewski and Suzanne O'Donnell as a most unconventional couple in this comedy full of sharp barbs, intense loyalty, and more than a little scandal. Boston Marriage runs through May 20th only. Tickets and info at www.1812productions.org.
I'm Marty Moscowane. It's the second day of the spring membership campaign. Have you made a pledge of support yet? Since you listen to WHYY, you owe it to yourself to be a supporter to ensure the future of in-depth news and analysis. You decide what that's worth and then make a call. Here's that phone number. It's 1-888-345-9499. That's 1-888-345-WHYY. Or you can pledge online at WHYY.org. Thanks.
ChristianaCare Health System's Center for Heart and Vascular Health supports WHYY. Studies show experience makes a difference in patient outcomes. Recognized by the Society of Thoracic Surgeons, ChristianaCare cardiovascular surgeons perform more than 800 open heart procedures each year. And the team of heart specialists treats more than 8,000 total heart and vascular patients annually. ChristianaCare, with locations in Pennsylvania and Delaware. More online at ChristianaCare.org/heartleaders.
This is Radio Times. I'm Artie Moss-Cohen. Today is the second day of the Greater Philadelphia Food Stamp Challenge, organized by the Greater Philadelphia Coalition Against Hunger and the Jewish Federation of Greater Philadelphia. I, along with other participants, including elected officials, are going to live on $35 of food for the week. At least we're going to try to do that. That's the amount of money, basically $5 a day, a Philadelphia food stamp recipient receives. The program is now known as SNAP, which stands for the Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, and it's facing cuts and tougher requirements for recipients. We asked Carrie Morgan, the head of the Greater Philadelphia Coalition Against Hunger, to join us. And Carrie, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thanks for having me on, Marty.
How many participants in this food stamp challenge?
Well, we have about 120 people taking part, which is great, and a lot of elected officials and people in leadership positions who might normally not experience this sort of poverty.
Well, and I have to include myself in that
yes,
I am not poor. I have a job, I have a house, so I'm going to try to live on these food stamps, but in no way is my experience like someone that actually depends on food stamps.
Right, and I think that what the purpose of the food stamp challenge is to really give people a brief glimpse into what it might be like to live on food stamps. And those people, and I'm sure you are experiencing some of those challenges, the challenge to plan for a week's worth of meals, the challenge of not being able to buy all that you want or the kinds of products you want. Certainly, it doesn't give the full breadth or depth of the problem. You don't have to go through the experience of actually getting food stamps, which is very difficult. And at the end of the week, you're done with the experience, so you don't have that continued challenge. But I think it does give an awareness, and it, you know, inspires sympathy about the program and the people who are on the program, and hopefully moves people to action so that we don't have the draconian cuts that we're seeing come down from both the federal and the state levels.
Now, Carrie, you're doing this food stamp challenge. What did you buy for your $35, or how are you doing that?
I am, and I bought pasta, and I bought yogurt and bananas, which is what I normally have for breakfast in the day. What I found challenging is really including drinks in my everyday life. You know, coffee. I love my morning coffee, and I love my 3 o'clock soda. And those were things that I had to make choices about. I think as time goes on, it's really going to become much harder over the weekend when my diet isn't as regimented as it is during the week. And I'm sure you've face similar challenges.
Well, indeed. I bought pasta, I bought rice, I bought beans, I bought lentils. I was able to get a couple of bargains for some vegetables.
Right.
But I have to say, and I bought a jar of tomato sauce for my pasta for a dollar. And I, to be honest with you, I normally spend more on a better pasta, and it doesn't taste very good. It has a kind of metallic-y taste to it.
Right. Yeah, you aren't going to be able to buy the quality products that you would normally buy. You continually look for the deals and what's going to make that food budget stretch versus what's going to taste good.
Now, $35, that's typical for a Philadelphia recipient of food stamps, as we refer to them.
Right, that's a single-person home, and you know, it equates to about $5 a day, which when you break it down that far, really doesn't go very far.
And looking across the state, it's 113. It's less if you live outside of Philadelphia. Is that right?
Yeah, food stamp benefits generally people aren't eligible for as much in other parts of the state on average.
And for people that are relying on food stamps, are there other benefits other food benefits that they can get from other programs, or are they solely reliant on SNAP or food stamps?
Well, what we refer to SNAP as is the gateway benefit, because so many of the benefits complement and are related to the food stamp benefit. For example, school meals. If you're on food stamps, you're automatically eligible for school meals. And I think what's important to realize, especially when we're talking about budget cuts, is food stamps help people make ends meet, and they really allow people to fulfill their basic needs without having to make difficult choices. So people don't have to sacrifice food to get the prescriptions they need. That's especially important when you're talking about seniors or people with disabilities. They won't have to sacrifice their rent to put food on the table. So these are all the choices that people have to make every day when they're living with hunger, with food insecurity, and in poverty.
And I have to say, just looking at my small supply of food, I don't know if I have enough to make it for the week. I'm not trying to be overly dramatic here, because obviously I've got a house full of food that I can turn to. But I'm thinking about people who are on food stamps, and do they turn to family members or pantries? I mean, there are other ways to supplement the food that they need, but they don't have.
Yeah, absolutely. So they'll turn to family members first, but then usually in the third or fourth week, we see people turning to food pantries. And for the past few years, the food pantries have not been able to keep up with the demand. And that's why this whole range of benefits is so important, so that people don't have to make those choices. But when you're talking about cutting both food stamps and LIHEAP, then people are going to have to absorb those costs to heat their homes and put food on the table. So I think that, you know, these choices are going to be much harder for people, and we're going to see a lot more people asking for help that's not necessarily going to be there. Just the other day, we got a call from an 8-year-old girl who wanted food. She was hungry. And I've worked at the Coalition for 5 years, but we've never had an 8-year-old call to say she was hungry and she wanted us to leave a box of food on her doorstep.
What did you do for her?
Well, we tracked down where she was and we got her the help she needed, but I don't want any more 8-year-olds calling my office for food. It's we should be ashamed that we aren't taking care of our children, that we aren't taking care of our seniors, and that we aren't taking care of our neighbors in general. We really have to watch it when we're thinking about reducing the benefits in these programs.
And when you talk about reducing, are we talking about reducing on a state level, on a federal level?
Both. So we're seeing more rigid restrictions on the state level. And, you know, we've talked many times about the asset test that's being implemented on May 1st so that people with $5,500 in assets above that, they would be disqualified from participating in the food stamp program. But we're also seeing huge cuts on the federal level. In 2010, they cut $14 billion from the SNAP program. And unless people speak out and say that hunger is unacceptable and that those funds should be restored, families of four are going to see a $60 decrease per month in their benefits.
And you're talking about families with assets of $5,500, and I think for households with seniors or people with disabilities, it's $9,000. Now,
correct.
They don't count a car. And there are certain things that don't get counted, right?
Right. There are some things that don't get counted, and the first car is not counted, but the second car is. So generally, if you're living in a rural area, you are a two-parent family, and you have two different workplaces, that's going to be difficult for you.
So how many, do you know, in Pennsylvania or even in this greater Philadelphia area, how many working people rely on food stamps?
There are, it's almost about half of the food stamp population in the country rely on food stamp program. About 50% of food stamp recipients are either seniors or disabled or children. So, but I think that's a misperception that people who are working don't use food stamps and that you can't get the benefit if you are working. But a lot of workers, it was really built as a work support.
Oh, that's in its original incarnation?
Yeah, in its original incarnation, and, you know, especially right now when we're talking about the recession and people having to take jobs that render them underemployed, where they're not making as much as they used to but want to stay employed, you're seeing a lot of people who need that extra money to put food on the table, and they rely on food stamps to do that.
Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Carrie Morgan, our guest, Executive Director of the Greater Philadelphia Coalition Against Hunger. I'm Marty Moscoe, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY. Let me get, looks like Robert from SkipAct to join us. And Robert, go ahead. You're on Radio Times. I think we seem to have lost Robert. Well, we'll hopefully get him back on the line at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Carrie, let me just go back to something you just said. So half of the recipients are either seniors or people with disabilities or children.
Correct.
And the other half of recipients are what, a mix of working people, or who's in the other half?
It's a mix of people. It's working people. It's people who are unemployed, especially people who are recently unemployed. A lot of people whose unemployment benefits have run out rely on food stamps. You know, I think what has really come across in terms of our work and hearing callers that call our hotline for help, you never know whether it can happen to you. And we're seeing people who never thought they would be in this position call for help, and they're so ashamed to call for help because they never thought they would have to experience this sort of, you know, uncertainty about whether they can put food on the table. So it could happen to anyone, and I think a lot of the prejudice against the benefit and the judgments are really stemmed from the fear that it could happen to you.
Do you think there's prejudice against the people on food stamps?
Oh, sure. There's a lot of prejudice. There's a lot of judgment. And I think one of the things that stood out to me in taking the food stamp challenge, food stamp recipients are often called lazy. But it takes a lot of work and a lot of planning to prepare for the week and create a balanced diet on such little money. Most people, no one wants to be hungry, and most people do not want to be on food stamp benefits. They're ashamed to call us. They're ashamed to ask for help. So many of the perceptions around the benefit are unjustified.
One of the criticisms, and I'd like you to answer that, is that this is a program rife with waste, fraud, and abuse. Is there research that has looked at that?
There is. There's a ton of research that has looked at that, and the fraud rate is actually less than 1%. And advocates and the government have gone out of their way over the years to make sure that fraud is at its lowest rate possible. And they've made great strides in decreasing the amount of fraud. So when you're talking about less than 1%, and most of it is on the retailer end, you really don't have an argument towards waste, fraud, and abuse that's rife in the program. That's one of the misperceptions.
Let me get Charlene from, it looks like Colorado, to join us on Radio Times. And Charlene, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
I actually would like to preface this with, you know, I'm a supporter of government programs to feed the hungry. But I'm just concerned about the perception of food stamps. I have a sister that works at the deli counter in Bristol, Pennsylvania.
Oh, sure.
And she's always telling me stories about, you know, people on food stamps that come in and they get crab legs, they get, you know, name brand deli meat like Dietz and Watson. And she actually, it upsets her because she can't afford those things. She's working at the deli counter. So, you know, she has to get generic lunch meat and, you know, she can't afford crab legs. So I'm concerned about that perception out
sure.
there that people are living on food stamps but not living, you know, spending too much and living extravagantly on food stamps
fair
or better than they should.
Fair enough. Charlene, I appreciate the fact that you called. And Carrie, go ahead.
Well, I think, you know, with stories like that, and we do hear them sometimes, but you have to remember, if you're buying crab legs or expensive food, those benefits aren't going to last.
Mm.
So you may have that quality food for a few days, but, you know, by the time you get into your second week, you're pretty much going to be out of money. So the benefit is the benefit, and we believe that people should have the right to choose what kinds of foods they want to eat. But the money only goes so far. So in the third and fourth week, these customers that are going to the deli counter may be turning somewhere else or may be hard up to, you know, actually feed their families.
Let me see if I can squeeze one more caller on. Carol from Reading. And Carol, we're almost out of time, but go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, I'm 53 years old, unemployed for a year, and I'm on food stamps. I used to live a really good life, ate organic food all the time. I'm a cancer survivor. My doctor suggested going organic. On $35 a week, you cannot eat organic food. Sometimes I buy something organic, but it's true. It uses up a big amount of my money. And so I am eating a diet that I do not want to eat. I'm very thin, and my doctor says I should keep eating more. Doctor, by the way, who sees me almost pro bono because I have no health insurance now. God bless her. And but yeah, so you're eating that stuff that tastes like metal, and you're eating pasta all the time. And pasta, I mean, I haven't eaten meat in over a year. I just cannot afford it, and I don't want to eat junky meat. That again, you know, trying to be healthy. So it is very much a struggle, and someone brought me some Belgian endive the other day, and they could have brought me
a platter of gold.
Yeah, no. I just appreciate it. She was just stopping by. She goes, they had a sale here, and a lot of friends, thankfully, invite me over for dinner and send me home with leftovers. I don't know what I would do.
Well, Carol, I'm so sorry to hear that, obviously, and I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And let me give Carrie just a quick response.
Oh,
you're very welcome, Carol. And Carrie, we're almost out of time. Any just quick comment?
Well, and I think that, the caller speaks to the problem of if we cut on the food stamp side, the medical cost of that and the medical cost impacts are going to be huge. When you don't eat healthy food, your medical costs are going to go up, and that is going to be passed on to everybody in the state and in the country. So we really have to think about those things, the greater and longer-term implications.
Well, Carrie Morgan, thanks for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thanks so much, Marty, for having me. Good luck with the challenge.
Yeah, same to you. And she's the executive director of the Greater Philadelphia Coalition Against Hunger. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. In fact, go to our Facebook page where I am talking about my experience on the food stamp challenge. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Stay with us. We'll be right back.